Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inch. Glad to have you with us. Just a quick word about the second hour this morning. We'll be doing our regular Talk to the Family Doctor program. We do that every other month with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic. He deals with people of all ages in his practice. So if you have questions about yourself, your children, your family members, you're certainly welcome to call in and talk with him in hour number two. In hour number one, we'll be talking about where we are now with modern genetic science, as scientists have tried to map out the human genetic material and try to figure out what does what in that material and what that means for the way we think about race. We'll be talking this morning with Troy Duster. He is professor of sociology at New York University and is also chancellor's professor and director of the American Culture Center at the University of California at Berkeley, and is very interested in science and public policy and race and ethnicity. He was here visiting the campus and gave a talk yesterday that's part of a series that's being sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus that will spread this over this semester and next, looking at issues and opportunities raised by the new biology. And we expect that we'll have a number of the folks here on this program so that people who can't attend the talks will still have an opportunity to hear what they have to say and discuss these issues. And this is the first, and we're pleased that Professor Duster is here. As we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
It seems just to set the stage for this discussion of race and science, probably it's worth starting with the notion that it does seem that at this point here in America, we're making at least a good faith effort. Some people are making a good faith effort to get around the idea of race. At least we talk that way, as if we'd like that to be the case, believing that race shouldn't really matter, believing that everybody, even if they look a little bit different on the outside, are the same on the inside. Seemingly going hand in hand with that, some of the information that comes to us in the popular media about the Human Genome Project. And I suppose the headline there would be something like, essentially on the genetic level, everybody is enough alike so that it's almost not worth discussing.
Indeed. You sort of put your finger on the public discussion of the last decade, where a remarkable consensus among scientists, humanities scholars, social scientists, that the concept of race is on the run, at least on the public stage. What strikes me is the emerging consensus on the topic, sort of with the dot on the I and the cross of the T, with human molecular genetics, which is discovered in the last few years, that at the DNA level, we are remarkably alike. That is, you can't go down to the DNA and make any determinations about racial differences, which are mapping onto discrete categories. Now, there are patterns of different groups with respect to vulnerability for diseases or certain kinds of, obviously, expressions phenotypically. That is, the way the skin is colored or the way the eye fold is developed. But those are very superficial. When it comes down to whether or not there's patterns of neurotransmission or whether or not the blood types can be mapped onto anything called race, it has long since been dispensed. So at the biological level, there is this articulate, forceful decision that's been made that race is no longer a concept that we want to be talking about as if it were discrete. The problem for me is that when we then move to applications, the way in which this concept of race develops in terms of medical science and health delivery, pharmaceuticals on the one hand. On the other, what happens with determinations of, let's say, culpability or innocence with respect to DNA testing and the law, things get more complicated. So on the one hand, you've got this public framing of the problem that is we're going to get rid of race. And with that, I'm in basic agreement in terms of the biology. That is, it's true that you can't make these distinctions. However, and here's where things start to get complicated, when we move to the way in which pharmaceuticals are now being developed. They're being developed with respect to the delivery to, quote, populations which are more likely to get this pharmaceutical and be affected by it positively.
Yeah. Well, let's talk, maybe we should talk in a little bit more concrete way about what it is we're talking about. Because it, while we do say, and it is true, when you look at people on the level of their DNA, that everyone is 99% the same.
99.9%.
But there are still tiny differences. And one of the things that we are coming to appreciate is the fact that there are many diseases that have some kind of genetic component, and that because within ethnic groups there tend to have been relatively closed gene pools, we can look at particular kinds of diseases like sickle cell for one, or Tay-Sachs for another, and there are others, and that we say that people of particular ethnic backgrounds are at greater risk. We see greater numbers of those diseases in those populations. So then that sort of gets us back to the idea of, well, there are coherent groups of people, and there are differences between them, and that there are even perhaps differences in what kind of diseases they might get.
Yes, indeed. That's the other development of the last three decades, which has been somewhat ironic. That is, while we're saying that race is of not much consequence, we're also developing genetic tests, which are designed for particular population groups, which often happen to be correlated to ethnic and racial populations. So you mentioned Tay-Sachs, which is primarily a disease of the neurological system, and Jews of Ashkenazic descent are at highest risk for that. Cystic fibrosis, a disease of the lungs, primarily North European ancestry. So on the one hand, we're saying race or ethnicity is not very important. On the other hand, we're discovering at the level of risk for a gene disorder that there are certain patterns. And then to complicate matters, when we developed gene tests, genetic tests for cystic fibrosis, the mutation for which we had the test is primarily of a particular group. Let's say in this case it's Delta F508, which is just a mutation name for that disease for North Europeans, while the Zuni Indians have another mutation for cystic fibrosis, and there is no gene test for them. So here comes the role of the social political analyst, because now the capacity of a group to get its, quote, disease research funded is very much a function of their social, political, and economic power, or their sheer numbers, their demography, their ability to influence the Congress. And back in the 60s, sickle cell was a very poorly funded disease. In the early 70s, there was mobilization. And so the issue of race comes up, not so much at the level of the DNA, but it comes up in the sense that groups that are able to see their, quote, collective interests, their ethnicity or their race, and then push for, quote, their disease to be funded, suddenly have a huge advantage over those like the Zuni Indians who have not been able to get their disease funded. So this issue about ethnicity and race starts to get very complicated, even in research funding and science, because you can see that the basis for decision-making about gene testing is in part a function of racial, ethnic divisions, mobilization capacity politically and economically.
So it can cut two ways, because you've seen in the case with sickle cell that it's actually the fact that African Americans have mobilized around the disease has been good, because it's meant that we are now putting more resources into doing research than we were before.
Exactly.
But if you do have a group that doesn't either have the numbers or perhaps the experience of organizing around some particular issue, then they're going to be at a disadvantage.
You can see it with breast cancer and prostate cancer, because breast cancer is now very much a part of the public discourse. A lot of resources in the last 10 years for breast cancer. And we will see, I think, increasingly work being done on prostate cancer at this level. But let's say we find that prostate cancer is more frequently a function of being in a risk population that happens to be African American as opposed to Zuni. Now, that social reality that is also a biological reality. And so you might get a lot more funding and research for prostate cancer for that reason, just because of the capacity of a group to mobilize. So that's sort of the hidden, often unstated feature of the science-race dynamic. A group has a higher risk for a certain disorder, and if they are able to mobilize politically, they can get, quote, their research or their disease funded. And the flip side of this is pharmaceuticals. An industry that wants to make money is going to produce a pharmaceutical intervention for a disorder that is going to be for the group with the greatest likelihood of coming up with the funding.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Troy Duster. He is professor of sociology at New York University. He's also chancellor's professor and director of the American Culture Center, University of California, Berkeley, and is very interested in the issues here we're talking about, science and public policy and race and ethnicity. He's visiting the campus. He gave a talk yesterday in this series that I mentioned that's been organized by the Center for Advanced Study, and we hope to have many of these people here on the program to talk about some of the issues and opportunities raised by the new biology. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think one of the things that you talked about in your talk yesterday was this interesting idea of ethnically targeted pharmaceuticals. That is, if we recognize within certain populations there are they may be at greater risk for certain diseases, or maybe even it's not necessarily the case that they're at greater risk for certain diseases, but that diseases, they might respond differently to treatment than other groups. So then you start thinking about, well, maybe for something that is as common as heart disease, for example, which is very common in the American population, you might say, well, you know, it may be that that European American men and African American men are different enough so that we should start thinking, well, you know, maybe it would make sense for there to be a different medicine for African American men and European men to take. Maybe they react, because we know everybody reacts differently to medications. Right. That's why we have lots of different ones. But maybe we get to the point where we think, well, they're different, and maybe we could treat their disease better if we had one drug for one group, one drug for another group.
Well, that's what's happened. We've got a double-edged sword here. Back in March of this year, a pharmaceutical company, Nitromed, introduced to the FDA a request for development of a drug called Bidil. And this drug is designed almost exclusively in the literature that's being put out by Nitromed for African-American men. And the argument is that since African-Americans have a much higher rate of particular kind of heart disease, that this drug, Bidil, will help them more than it will any other group. Now, this is a complex topic, and so I don't want to make it sound like there's an easy answer. But it does occur to me that this is a foot in the door of a new kind of medicine. Now, we start to market drugs. I think the Financial Times headline was, "The first ethnic drug being approved by the FDA." And I do think it's interesting that the first drug being introduced was for African-Americans. I think it has to do with the politics of race. That had the first drug been for white Americans, people would have said, well, this is an extraordinary bias. Why should those who are already privileged in terms of economic circumstance have a drug designed for them? But I do think this is the foot in the door of the next stage, that in the next few years, we're going to see much more of this kind of attempted marketing of drugs. And it is the foot in the door of a new kind of thinking.
Yeah. Of course, and I suppose one potential pitfall of thinking that way is, as I mentioned, that you get a group of people, you give them a particular medication, everybody's going to respond differently. Maybe in some people it will work really well, and some people maybe not so well. That's why often physicians right. have to try different sorts of things. And here in this case, say we've got this medication that was specifically designed for African-American men. Well, I think we can be fairly sure that for some African-American men, it's not going to work, and for some European-American men, it will work. And the risk is, I suppose, that now here I'm a physician and I have two patients, and one is a black man and one is a white man, and I'm thinking, well, okay, here's African-American man. We're going to give him the African-American man's drug, yes. and the white man, we're going to give him right. the one that's for European-Americans. And that may, in fact, not be the most effective medication for those two. Yeah. Right.
And that's clearly one of the dangers of this kind of development. I mean, one can see why the black hematologists are in favor of this, because they see the effects of different medications and they see that this might have a better effect on a population of blacks. But you're quite right. There's no doubt that there will be many whites who would take this drug and be affected positively, and many blacks who would take it and be affected negatively. So we've got to be very alert to the original insight we began with, namely, there's no clear, discrete mapping along racial lines for any of these pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm.
Is there, do you think, concern also that when you're talking about diseases that have some kind of lifestyle or environmental component, and we certainly believe that there are a lot of diseases, like cancer and heart disease and probably a lot of other things that do that, then again, we're not going to put the emphasis that we should on those factors if we get into too much thinking about the fact that this is, it's biological, it's mm-hmm. genetic, it has to do with that makeup, and not so much these other sorts of things.
Well, indeed. Let's stay with heart disease, because that's the clear case. There was a research reported about a decade ago by Michael Clagg and his associates, the New England Journal, and they concluded after a 4 or 5 year major study in the United States that being black, indeed having darker skin and being black, put one at greater risk for hypertension. And in this research, they concluded that it wasn't so much that skin color itself was the source of hypertension, but rather the social response to those with darker skin color. Even inside the black community, there is a system of stratification by color. So the darker the skin, the higher the hypertension rate. And what Clagg and his associates concluded was that this was not so much a biological issue at the level of, whether the skin color produces the outcome, but rather that because in this society, skin color puts one at greater risk as one is darker for access to, let's say, housing or resources, this might explain the differences that were being disclosed. Now, Clagg and his associates concluded that racism and poverty, therefore, might be at issue with respect to explaining higher rates of hypertension. Now, notice the sharp contrast with that version of what causes hypertension or how to treat it and the Nitromed decision-making of the last 6 months, where they've concluded that the way to handle hypertension is with this drug called Bidyl, increasing the amount of nitrous oxide. They claim that blacks have insufficient supply. So there are competing paradigms here, competing versions of how you explain and how you treat a disease. And that's going to happen, for example, with cancer. If you move to the question of prostate cancer, black males have double the rate of prostate cancer in the age group 50 to 70. Well, why? Is it because being black puts them at risk for cancer in some way that's biological, or being black puts them in some kind of situation that's social, closer living to, let's say, toxic waste dumps or capacities, let's say the capacity to have a certain kind of a nutritional intake. Maybe that is what keeps them at this high rate of prostate cancer. We don't know. But if you've got a technology like the new molecular biology, which inclines you to look for the DNA differences, that may prejudice the strategy for how you think about medical intervention.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting also to think about the way over time, perhaps over the last 100 years or so, I guess, we've thought about disease and why mm-hmm. people get sick. And that around the turn of the century, there seemed to be a real appreciation for and an effort to do something about public health. And we sort of came to understand at that time, maybe that was about all that we could do. We came to understand that we could get people to be much healthier if we could make sure that they had a reliable supply of clean water. And if we made sure that waste was, we dealt with waste in the proper way. And perhaps we did things that we could to, you know, clean up the environment and clean up the air. And before there was there were antibiotics and modern science, we did those things, and there was a significant improvement in human health. Once we then got to the point where science developed so that we started to realize that there were germs and that then we had something to do about them, then it seems that more and more we got away from public health, we got into the technological approach, and that got us also started thinking about the fact that if people got sick, well, maybe it was something they were doing. More and more, then we put the weight on this idea that, well, if you got sick, it was your fault because it was something that you did. It seems that we're even now that we're getting into the more and more of the idea that illness is about genes, then it still means that there's something wrong with you.
Yes.
And we even have moved farther away from this idea that the circumstances in which people live have a great impact on their health. We seem to have kind of forgotten that.
Yeah. I think that's very vital for this discussion about the new molecular biology, because as you point out, there was a point in which there was a collective interest in public health, and that's a very, very salutary. It's a very happy history in some ways. We really have conquered smallpox, and tuberculosis is not completely eradicated, but it was a consensus development. Now, with molecular biology, one can applaud the developments which show we can now determine whether or not someone has a particular disorder and do symptomatic treatment. So I'm in favor of that. But there's the flip side of this, and that is the fact that because gene disorders are located in certain risk populations, then the public health consensus about what to do has been fractured. So now the question is, if my disease is beta thalassemia, which is South Mediterranean or Southeast Asian, and your disease is cystic fibrosis, which is North European, then we may have an interest group conflict about how science is funded in those two diseases. You look at the last 30 years and you see a table of funding figures, and you see what I'm talking about in terms of the way the Congress has moved to fund certain kinds of research. So the public health consensus, which was a wonderful thing at the turn of the century, we can all agree, let's get rid of smallpox. Why? Because we're all at risk for smallpox. But if you've got beta thalassemia and I've got sickle cell anemia and she's got Huntington's disease and so forth and so on, then we have to begin to rethink this whole question of what is a public health strategy with genetic disorders.
Well, I suppose some people might say, though, wouldn't it be appropriate if we said, well, we've only got so much money. We have to prioritize how we're going to spend our money. Shouldn't we start with those conditions that affect the largest number of people? Now, perhaps we actually haven't done that.
We haven't done that, and with a vengeance. That is part of what I was suggesting yesterday in my remarks, was that we put the greatest amount of money into some disorders which were indeed very, very rare back in the late 60s, early 70s. And we put very little money into sickle cell and cystic fibrosis, which were much more frequent. So I think there is a good argument for taking a look at genetic disorders in terms of this, what's called maximizing the health benefits and disease burden, is a language that they use at the NIMH in Washington, which tries to spell out this whole question of where do you put research funding and why. But that's a contentious area, and I just think we need to face up to it as opposed to treating it as if it's not a question of remarkable moment in public health.
Our guest this morning, we're at our midpoint or just a tiny bit over. Our guest this morning is Troy Duster. He's professor of sociology at New York University, and he is chancellor's professor and director of the American Culture Center, University of California, Berkeley. We're talking about what the new biology has to tell us about race, or perhaps how we're thinking about race in light of the new biology. He's here visiting the campus, part of what will be a year-long series of discussions, and we hope to have many of the people here on the show to talk about them, discussions of issues and opportunities raised by the new biology. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, we've talked here about one area, that is biology, medicine, race, and genomics. Let's shift and talk about another subject that I know that you're interested in, and you talked a little bit, and that has to do with essentially with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. We're now starting to build a database of genetic material of people who have been arrested, suspected of crimes. Mm-hmm. The idea is that perhaps in future we're more and more going to use DNA evidence. Mm-hmm. So if we come upon a crime scene, we can collect some evidence. Then we have this large database of past offenders, and at least we can see if there's a match, to see if the evidence we find at this crime scene can be tied to any person that has come through the system
right
before. Mm-hmm. What's the problem with that?
Well, let's pull this into two different discussions. The first has to do with the use of DNA to exculpate those who are actually in prison. And there's an important development called the Innocence Project. Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld in New York have developed this project. And it's a wonderful development. That is, what they've done is to use DNA to free about 85 people, about 9 who are on death row, because they could use the data that they collected to show that the person could not have been the same person. Even though they were accused, there was identification, they were about to, again, die. So when DNA is used that way, we all wind up applauding it and saying it's a great development. So I want to be on board that particular version of applauding the new science. The second part of this is what you indicated, namely, when you have a large database of felons, let's take sex offenders as a good example, and you can therefore use that material in the database to check and see whether or not a new crime that you've got data for, because someone left tissue samples at the scene, whether there's a match. So now, quite the opposite of the first issue, which was that you could exculpate, you could get someone off because you see there's no match. Now you have the capacity to make a match and put someone in prison because you can now discover it's the same person. Again, one can see the important uses of that and applaud it. The thing that I'm interested in further exploration of is the question about who's in that database. And here we come back to the question of ethnicity and race. Because for the last 30 or 40 years, we have seen in this country the use of police decision-making with police profiling, in some ways initiated by the drug war, which has increased the capacity of the police discretion to stop, arrest, and ultimately put people into jails at the level that's extraordinary in American history. Between 1980 and 1995, we almost tripled our prison population. And in that period, the rate of increase for people of color was astronomical. I'll give you a quick version of this. Back in the 1920s, the ratio was about 2-1, black to white incarceration. By 1995, it was about 8-1. So a fourfold increase in different races being in prison. Now, let's go to the question of the DNA. If you've got a database which is primarily of one group, and you then move to the question of trying to understand why people commit crimes, you will get a research strategy in which some researchers will take a group of people, let's say a homicide or sex offense is one extreme, but how about violent criminals who simply, or people who are only using drugs? Now the question is, how do you explain their crime? And I guess my major concern here is that the technology inclines us to think in terms of looking at the DNA of people to see if we can find markers which explain their criminal behavior. Again, I don't think that's an easy answer, but I think it's something we need to be alert to.
So obviously one concern goes to the same issue that we were talking about before. That is environmental factors, essentially.
You know,
why is it that someone would end up committing a crime, being in jail, may have something to do with their genes, but seems much more likely to deal with, to have to do with the circumstances into which they were born, in which they grew up, in which they lived. And you're suggesting that we're if we're looking at the other thing, we're looking at the DNA, we may not be looking as closely at the other factors.
Right. And that was the reason why I gave the figure that back in the 20s, we had a very different rate of incarceration by race. Today, it's much, much different. And we will find possibly at the DNA level some patterns of black-white differences. We would conclude mistakenly that those differences might be explanatory for crimes.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose, too, there's the concern that if we decide we're going to go looking for genes that determine criminal behavior, and the only population we study are criminals, then maybe that doesn't really tell us. We're starting out with a biased sample, which then indeed may end up giving us flawed data, and that unless we truly sample everybody or what is a random sample.
Well, indeed. This is part of the discussion that Howard Seyfer, who was former police chief at New York, was engaged in a few months ago with Peter Neufeld and me and a few others at a conference. And what he said was, well, I appreciate your concern that there may be racial bias or racial profiling in the DNA database. Why don't we get everybody into the gene pool? So now what's going to happen is an argument. So you want to reduce racial profiling in the gene pool. Let's have everybody, all citizens, submit their DNA. And now we're into an issue of civil liberties. And it turns out since September 11th, we're going to have an increased and heightened discussion of the role of government and all of these matters.
Mm-hmm. I know that more and more information became available as the Human Genome Project went along, it seemed that we were in the media more and more hearing stories about someone who felt that they found a gene for something. Mm-hmm. And we went from talking about the idea that cancer might be genetically determined, heart disease, and we started finding genes for all kinds of stuff. The other day, someone said they think that they found a gene for language. Mm-hmm. Someone in the past has said that they think they found a gene for adventurousness, you know, mm-hmm. that somehow being an explorer was somehow genetic. And mm-hmm. people have postulated that, indeed, there may be genes for criminal mm-hmm. behavior.
Yes.
Is that something that we're really taking seriously?
Well, there are different kinds of research strategies, but one of the most popular ones, which is coming out of the convergence of the computer technology, is the use of computers to find markers. Now, this is a different strategy than trying to talk about explanations of behavior, because now you're talking about whether or not there's a marker on the DNA for people who might be inclined towards homosexuality or have a certain kind of linguistic inclination. So you get a marker. And then you conclude because you've got this marker that there must be a gene for. And that's a huge industry currently. That's, I think, quite popular, in part because the computer technology permits it. We can now put people's DNA on these computer chips and find these patterns. That's a long way from understanding gene function. To have a gene marker, to say that we can know on chromosome 6 at a certain level, here's a marker for what we think might be homosexual behavior, that's a huge leap from saying we understand the function of the gene, coding for a protein, producing the cell decision-making, and so on. So there's a huge leap between the DNA and behavior that is not being accounted for by these studies of gene markers.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be this is one of those issues where it's the proverbial pendulum. We swing back and forth in the way that we feel about the relative importance of environment and of genetics in determining who people are and how they behave and what they are. And at this point now that we're so much into the genomic mapping and discovering genes and saying that we think things do certain things, that the pendulum has definitely swung over to the gene side.
Definitely. Discussions about violence, for example. There was a big meeting at the NIH in Washington a few years ago on how you explain violence. And I was really struck by how many people took the view that we could move to the level of what's happening inside the individual, neurophysiological, biochemical, genetic accounts of violence, as opposed to the fact that people live in certain conditions and certain neighborhoods where there is mainly the violence that we're concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Well, how, you know, given the fact that we know that it does, discussions like these do swing sometimes between extreme poles, what happens to move it back? I mean, does it have to get to the point where we would have years and years of research that would be going down this line, and that eventually what would happen is that we would say, well, you know, we've looked at this question for a long time, and I think actually now we've decided, no, it's not as simple as straightforward as that. We don't really know that there's any criminal gene. So we're going to again start thinking about the fact that who people are is some interaction, some very complicated interaction between their environment and their genetic makeup.
That's already begun to happen. There are now developments all over the world, but especially in the United States, what they call integrative biology, where they're now talking more and more about the ways in which there is an interaction between different genes. They're talking about proteomics, a new term. They're talking about not so much how there's a gene for something, but there's a complex interaction with genes and decision-making in the cell level. And then finally to the larger environment. And so what we're finding in this last 3 to 5 years is the pendulum swinging back to the interaction effects as opposed to the single gene determination. Mm. And that's a healthy sign.
And how long do you think that it will be before the popular media catches on and a little bit more balanced sort of coverage?
See, that's not a very interesting story. A headline which says things are complex isn't going to sell very many papers. If you say you got a headline which says we've discovered the gene for homosexuality or the gene for violence, that's a big story. And so without badgering or butchering the media, I do think the question about what's an interesting story does occupy a lot of the decision-making about headlines.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's also the case that that science and technology are fields that are not easy for journalists to cover, and that there aren't very many people who specialize in doing it. And I think it can be difficult if you don't specialize in doing it.
That's true. But I do think even those who understand the complexities, sometimes they're up against maybe a very short soundbite or a very short article where they're forced to submit to this notion that, well, it's complex, but really, folks, we found the gene for something.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I should again introduce our guest. We're speaking with Troy Duster. He's professor of sociology at New York University. And he's also Chancellor's Professor and Director of the American Culture Center at University of California, Berkeley. And he's spending some time here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He gave a talk yesterday. He's a speaker in this series that we will be following here on this program, organized by the University of Illinois Center for Advanced Study, looking at some of the issues and opportunities raised by the new biology. We're really pleased that over the years we've had a good relation with the center and have had many speakers here on this program so that we can bring them to a little bit wider audience, just beyond those people who could go to the talks here in Champaign-Urbana. So questions are certainly welcome. The number here is 333-9455, or WILL. That's for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. And, of course, anyone listening to us anywhere, either around the Midwest or on the Internet, can use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We do have a couple of callers here getting lined up, and I think we'll start out with our toll-free line, our line number 4. The caller is in Aurora. Hello.
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. Good morning. Very interesting subject. I don't know if this what I'm going to ask is in your division or not, but there was a woman visiting me on Saturday that said she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and she told me how it took them 3 or 4 months to finally diagnose her, and she spoke about it. And then she mentioned the fact of where she worked, and she said she was one of 2 other people where she works, in the division where she works, that were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis also. Now, what is done about a situation like that? Is that reported to anybody? because there is a cluster of three people that get multiple sclerosis in an office?
Well, the answer to that, usually, if there is a pattern of a disease which assumed might be a function of toxic waste or some other issue, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta are the places where people report those things. And so I guess that would be my advice, that if there seems to be a pattern of an illness, even an illness which seems to be primarily one which may be primarily, let's say, genetic, still there's, what we were saying earlier in the program, is a feedback loop between biology and the environment. So the strong advice would be to talk about how this gets into the database at the Centers for Disease Control.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Is, like, the boss there, is he compelled or is he told, or is there some thing that he has to do about a situation like that, or is it up to the patient to make it?
My guess is that it's up to the patients to begin to report those kinds of things. There's no requirement in law for reporting those kinds of things.
I just thought there might be something that spoke to that matter, because sometimes the patient, she seemed rather stressed, and sometimes the patient is just not in a condition to do it herself. That was my feeling about it, and I just wondered how they pursue those things. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to caller here, line number one. Caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yeah, your talk is very fascinating, and I'm glad to hear that someone's broaching this topic, because I've always felt that nature and nurture have been important in just about anything, whether you're talking about disease, whether you're talking about something you didn't talk about, intelligence, whether you're talking about social characteristics such as crime and other things. But so I'm complimenting you on this topic and both the questioner and the discussant. But my question is there anything in the press, and I'm talking about even academic press, that talks about these issues and compiles this type of information? Because I do have a collateral interest in this, and maybe you could cite some references for me if possible.
Let me make sure I understand your question. You're saying, is there a body of literature which talks about the race and forensics? Is that the question? Or race, let's say, in pharmacogenomics? The answer to both questions is yes.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get at is there any complications of this information? Like, for instance, is there a general article that surveys this? Has anybody ever summarize the literature in one article so that you could reference back to the other literatures if you're so interested?
I see. There's an article called Pharmacogenomics, the New Synthesis, that appeared about 2 years ago in Science magazine by Relling, and I believe the second author is Hamad, but I'm not positive. In any case, that would be about October 99. And that's pharmacogenomics, the issues of race, and the delivery of pharmaceuticals to different groups. That article would have a series of references which might interest you.
Okay.
Then this year, in March of 2001, it's an article, International Journal of Forensic Science, which talks about the use of the new DNA technologies with computers to what they call do ethnic estimation. And this is the use of this technology to determine whether or not someone at a crime scene is from one of five, quote, ethnic or racial groups. And that would be in March of 2001.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much. And thank you for covering this topic. I really am fascinated by what you guys have been saying.
Very good. Well, thanks for the call. We have about maybe 3 minutes left. If there was someone who really wanted to ask a question, they could do that right now and get on the telephone and dial us up. We'll get you in the time that remains. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Maybe just you could talk a little bit more about the very last point you touched on, the idea of, in a sense, in a forensics, a racial profiling of suspects?
Yes.
Or how exactly does that work?
Well, this technology is now moving along at a remarkably fast pace, and we now have an IBM computer that's being used with biological analysis that can do 7.3 trillion calculations per second on the DNA. So we now, for the first time, are able to put, let's say, 4,000 or 5,000 different persons of a particular racial group and put their thing on a computer and see if there are patterns in the what's called the SNP profiling. I don't want to get into the details of that, but it just means you can use a computer to get a profile of markers and see if these markers indicate if someone's from a, quote, ethnic or racial group. Well, those in forensic science want this technology. They're saying, well, if we have this capacity, we could go to a crime scene, get some material, and see whether or not we could rule out or rule in someone from an ethnic or racial group for further questioning. And that's being done currently mainly in England. But the technology is available in the United States, and it would not surprise me if we don't see this kind of development in the next year or two.
So you could go, rather than, you could go and you could collect evidence so that rather than simply later being able to say, if you have a suspect, you can look at the evidence and say, well, either this person is or is not the person. You could say, well, one thing we could tell you about this person is Asian.
Well, no, we can say probably. The language is always the language of probability. The ethnic estimation literature is all about 85% probability or 90% probability and so forth. So that the first article on this topic claimed 85% predictability of either, quote, Caucasian or UK ancestry was called versus Caribbean ancestry. And that's the way it'll be used. It will not be used in a kind of a discrete taxonomic system.
But that, again, that just gets you to how it is that, say, you're a police officer and you're investigating this, how it is that you're going to think about, in your mind, you've got to have some sort of a profile about, well, who is it that we're looking for? That it might lead you to think in certain ways that either would be correct or not.
Correct. Yeah. That's the way with the technology is leading us.
Well, I think at that point, we're going to have to leave it because we're here at the end of the time with our thanks to our guests, Troy Duster from both New York University and University of California, Berkeley. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it.